Welcome to Little Atoms on Resonance 104.4 FM, a live talk show based around ideas of the Enlightenment.
Little Atoms is presented by Neil Denny, Padre Greedy, Richard Sanderson and Rebecca Watson, as well as regular mystery guest presenters.
Little Atoms makes no claims to balance. We actively promote science, freedom of expression, skepticism, and secular humanism. This means we can often end up talking about superstition, religious fundamentalism, censorship, and conspiracy theory.
Our guests bring ideas that are challenging, sometimes controversial, often polemical, but always interesting.
Good evening and welcome to Little Atoms, this week hosted by me, Padre Greedy, and Neil Denny. Our guest this week is Graham Farmelow, and I will hand over to Neil to tell you more.
Thank you, Padre. Graham Farmelow is Senior Research Fellow at the Science Museum, London, and Adjunct Professor of Physics at Northeastern University in Boston, in the USA. Formerly a theoretical physicist, he is now an international consultant in science communication. He edited the best-selling It Must Be Beautiful, Great Equations of Modern Science in 2002. And Graham's latest book, which we'll be talking about tonight, is The Strangest Man, The Hidden Life of Paul Dirac, Quantum Genius. Graham, thanks for joining us this evening.
Oh, delighted to be here.
Well, let's begin by talking about Paul Dirac's early life and his sort of unusual upbringing, his family life before he becomes the renowned physicist.
Well, it's one of the great transitions, I think, because Dirac began his life, born in 1902, in a modest terrace in Bristol, and 30 years later he was somebody who was one of the greatest physicists in the world, and eventually, as we'll hear, he conceived half the universe in his head. So we're talking about an extraordinary story of somebody going from very modest backgrounds to the very pinnacle of abstract science. Now, that life he led in Bristol was, by his memory as an older man, extraordinarily bleak. From the outside, it looked a pretty regular family. His father was a school teacher, a Swiss, actually. His mother was what we would now call a homemaker, and he had a brother and sister. And it looked like a very respectable family. His father was a particularly good teacher. His mother, a very modest and self-effacing person. But behind those doors, if Dirac's story is correct, and he was a very literal-minded guy, was an ex-certificate family life. To show you how extraordinary it was, his father would only speak to his children in French, which is his own native tongue. His mother would only speak to the children in English. And when Dirac was 30, he actually told a reporter that he grew up thinking that men spoke French and women spoke English. This transferred itself to the Dirac mealtimes. These were particularly traumatic for Dirac, as we heard, because what would happen is the family was split into two. He and his father would sit in the front of the house talking French, while his mother, brother and sister would be in the kitchen speaking English. Now, that's strange enough, but what was really disturbing for Paul Dirac was that his father was an extreme disciplinarian and would punish Paul by denying him any his next request, whatever it was, if he made any mistake whatever in French. So if he botched a subjunctive, if he mispronounced a word, he would be denied his next request. Now, Dirac had very bad stomach problems as a young boy and often wanted to be sick. Like anybody else, he sometimes wanted to go to the bathroom at the table, but he'd be denied both those requests. So allow me to say, you can imagine what a trauma that was. Right. So this his upbringing, as recalled by him, was one where they had no visitors or almost no visitors, virtually no family life, and this horrible divided balkanization of his home, so to speak.
With his father being a school teacher, and you pointed out the picking silver language and so on, was there much of an emphasis on a high emphasis on education.
Very
in the family.
Much so. Yes. One thing Dirac did have was a very good education. His father was a very fine teacher, well known for getting kids through exams. His father was known as Dedder. That was his name. We don't know why. It's not a particularly good sounding. It's not a kind of pleasant sounding name. We don't know why he had that, but he had this fearsome reputation among students. But make no mistake, he was very, very keen that his children, in particular his boys, it has to be said, had a really good education. So it was, as Dirac's mother said, it was work, work, work all the time. And he went to good schools, incidentally. When he went to junior school, he was a very quiet boy. We know that from testimony at the time. And one of the people he didn't speak to in the playground was Cary Grant. He actually went to school with Cary Grant, who was a couple of years below him.
Well, one of the things, I think in the book there's, and you've already sort of hinted at this, but there is sort of an ambiguity here in that the one person we have this account of his childhood from is Dirac himself.
Yes.
Whereas his father seems to be like, you know, a stand-up member of the community, yeah. And when you read the letters that his mother wrote to him, there's no sort of hint of this stuff going
on.
That's
very true.
And the accounts of other students, where they would say he was a strict disciplinarian, but there's one that sticks out to me that the guy says, you know, he was a disciplinarian, but when I was older, I sort of saw the humanity in the man. So to what extent do you think there is sort of any doubt over Dirac's account of it? Almost that it's like some sort of fantasy.
Well, I wrestled with this for a long, long time, Neil. Remember that Dirac was very literal-minded.
Mm.
I worked on his life for 5 years, and I could count easily on one hand, right, I don't even need all those fingers, just the number of times I caught him exaggerating. I'll give you one example of exaggeration, mm-hmm. but it was very hard one. He once said that he never saw his parents eating together. Now, what an extraordinary thing to say, incidentally, right? On another account, he said he rarely saw them mm-hmm. eating together, right? Now, I know that may sound, but that's unusual for Dirac. Normally, he would give exactly the same account every time, right? And he was not known by anyone. He hadn't got, as far as I know, he didn't have any enemies, but no one thought of him as an exaggerator. Though you have that on one side, but as you absolutely rightly say, when you look at the letters, the extant letters from his father, certainly those from his mother, and you look at the loving family pictures, it's not the image you get of a horrible, tense family life. My feeling is, and I said, it's a reading of the life. You don't know for sure until we get some record of that more detailed than what we have at the moment. It's my reading is that I suspect his father was a disciplinarian at home. I suspect that his father followed the pattern of many fathers at that time by being a very tough father. Mm-hmm. I mean, my father was much tougher with me than I see the typical father being now, mm-hmm. and I suspect it was much more in keeping at that time. I suspect Dirac was also a very sensitive child. And I speculate in the book, I mean, at the end of the book, actually, but since you asked me to give my view of his childhood, my belief is, with all the evidence taken into account, that he was an autistic child.
Yeah.
And
possibly his father was as well.
Well, yes, that's taking it a bit further. But I suspect you had a child who was had almost no empathy with his parents. I mean, look what happened when his brother killed himself.
Yeah, this was the next thing I was going to raise.
His brother killed himself, and Dirac later blamed his father for denying his brother the wish to be a doctor, mm-hmm. right? And that may or may not be correct. But what really struck me was that he said it was only then, Mrs. Paul, that he understood that parents were supposed to love their children.
Yeah. Whereas his father is devastated by
his father was absolutely devastated. And to be fair, I said to Paul Dirac, he said this was a change in his life because, I say it again, until then he was 23 years old, he did not know that parents were supposed to love their children. Now, that just shows, at least to me, what an extraordinarily unempathetic person he was. Right, so I think you have a very, very complex situation there. As I said, the bit about this repeated sickness at the table is deeply disturbing, mm-hmm. though. Deeply disturbing. And Dirac's wife said that this didn't just happen occasionally; it happened repeatedly, day after day, many times a week. So, good. The extent of that trauma is almost unimaginable.
Let's look at, you've already mentioned that Paul Dirac had a particularly good education. Let's look at his early years up until the point before he gets to St John's, Cambridge, where the sort of majority of the work he's done. And at what point do you think it emerged? At what point did people first begin to take notice of him as somebody who would go on to become who he did?
Very bright. Yeah. Well, it was at the what we would now call secondary school. He was at the Merchant Venturer School in Bristol, a very, very fine school, a public school, in the sense that it was a state-funded school with lots of philanthropic interventions for the merchant venturers. And it gave him one of the best public educations in the country. That's the first thing to say. During the First World War, which were the years he was at secondary school, many of those young boys were tragically going off to the killing fields. Mm-hmm. So Dirac was very bright, right? And the people near the top of the class were going through very quickly. And Dirac was by then seen as exceptional. He was coming top in almost everything, right? So to answer your question, is that it was around that time. Mm-hmm. And by the time he goes into engineering, he followed his brother and into doing that. Notice, not physics or mathematics, yeah. Engineering. So many physicists think that Dirac was a dyed-in-the-wool physicist. He wasn't. He was an engineer. Right, when he went to university and then became a superstar, right, a superstar thinker at least. He was terrible with his hands, right? But what he was doing was making model aeroplanes, testing cars, using a lathe. He even learned how to use to do his tax form. So he was very practically minded, right? And he was then seen as a great student. The only black spot on his career was his practical work was terrible. Like me, he had bananas on the ends of all his fingers. Couldn't do anything practical. He even got a bad report from an internship in rugby, which was quite an achievement, actually. Apparently the only one they ever gave a bad report to.
So it's post the First World War, and Paul Dirac has not quite got to Cambridge yet.
Yes.
And then it's 1933, he wins a Nobel Prize.
Yeah.
So he shares a Nobel Prize
That's
with
right.
Schrödinger.
That's right.
So let's talk about what happened in the interim then. We should presumably talk about the Dirac equation, which is...
Can we take just a quick step back there?
Yeah, sure, absolutely.
The first thing to say is that he, in 1921, was probably the best engineering graduate Britain produced in the 20th century, right? And that coincided with a fierce economic downturn, rather like we're having now, right? What did he get as a reward for that? He got a certificate for unemployment. He couldn't get a job.
Mm-hmm.
One of his lecturers got him on a pure maths course, and he...
This was still at Bristol.
Still at Bristol, mm-hmm. And he went up the road and he did a maths degree, free, and he got it in 2 years. But now this is, again, his father comes in. His father was writing to Cambridge saying, my boy has exceptional talent. And he finally got into Cambridge, right? And he got in there as a PhD student. He wanted to study relativity because Dirac was passionate about relativity. When Einstein became a global superstar almost overnight, Dirac was very much taken with that. He fell in love with the concept of theoretical physics, the idea that you could use your head, you could use mathematics, you could use experiment, and if you like, make inspired guesses about the fundamental laws that run the universe. So that's when he started to fall in love with theoretical physics. And he went up to Cambridge, he wanted to do relativity, but he was denied that. And he studied instead quantum theory.
Mm-hmm.
And he had a terrific supervisor, a fellow called Rafe Fowler, who was a very, very good theoretician, not a global superstar, but a very, very fine physicist. And then Dirac did very solid work for 2 years until that tragic suicide of his brother when his productivity plummeted. But during the grieving process, Dirac heard from Germany the first news about quantum mechanics, not knowing, incidentally, that it was a right theory. It's very important to realise that. He thought this was a very mathematical, weird-looking thing. But what Dirac did was take that paper and take from one loose thread of Heisenberg's first paper and weave it into a golden tapestry that was his vision of quantum mechanics.
So, well, you're listening to Little Atoms with me, Padraig Reedy, Neil Denny, and our guest, Graham Farmelow. We're getting to the point now where we're really discussing why we are discussing Paul Dirac. Mm. What was the great breakthrough?
Dirac produced the most achingly beautiful version of quantum mechanics, working alone in Cambridge, where the German people were a cavalcade of mathematicians and physicists working collaboratively almost. He was working alone, right, and he produced this beautiful vision of quantum mechanics, unsurpassed, right? The best summary I can give is Freeman Dyson's at the Institute for Advanced Study in Princeton. He said that what distinguished Dirac among those pioneers of quantum mechanics was the purity of his papers. It was as his papers rained down on physics between 1925 and 1933 like perfectly formed statues falling from the sky. I think that's a beautiful description of Dirac's papers. You can still read them. They still look beautiful. They still have the perfection, if you like, of a Shakespeare sonnet, so to speak. And they were coming out one after the other. His really great breakthrough was the Dirac equation. Neil, you want to ask me about that?
Well, yeah. Well, as Little Atoms listeners will, I'm sure, know, the Dirac equation is a relativistic equation of motion for the wave function of an electron.
You've got a very elite set of listeners here.
Well, the listeners will know that if they also looked up a nice summation of it on Wikipedia this afternoon. So for that. So let's talk about what that actually means. What do those words actually mean? And I want to get us basically to his prediction of antimatter, basically, which is the other great,
absolutely.
But let's talk about the equation first.
Okay. Well, we said earlier on that there was this discovery of quantum mechanics, the most revolutionary theory of the 20th century, right? Widely accepted as being that, quite rightly accepted as being that. Now, the problem was that theory was not consistent with Einstein's special theory of relativity. That's a big problem, because all theories have to be consistent with that, basically. That was Einstein's thinking. So it was a problem to try to marry those two theories together. And 24 of the best theoreticians in Europe, and America indeed, were trying to do this. Dirac was the first person to do it properly. And what he did was to produce an equation that you can write on the palm of your hand that combines the first quantum mechanics with special relativity and produces a beautiful equation for the behaviour of the electron. That's the first material fundamental particle to be discovered. All right. So what you had there was this beautiful unity between these two subjects. And one of the reasons why it was regarded as a miracle and why Dirac was the superstar of 1928 when it was published was that it explained, coming out of the mathematics, the spin of the electron, which had been recently observed, but nobody understood it. What Dirac showed was that the quantum theory and relativity make it inevitable, so to speak. So that was seen as a complete miracle. Something that was seen as unexplained was suddenly explained in one go. Now, that equation, as I said, magnificent achievement, had problems with it. I don't want to go into what they all are, because it took years to sort them out. But it was incumbent upon Dirac to sort them out. And his solution entailed the following, that there should exist a particle that has exactly the same mass as the electron, weighs the same, but has the opposite electrical charge. And he rather gingerly said this particle ought to exist. And at the end of 1931, he came out and said this really quite strongly. But very few people took it seriously. That's a very important thing to bear in mind. Nobody was saying, oh, you know, Dirac must be right. They said, oh, this is just another one of his speculations. The following year, raining down on the skies in California, in Caltech, the great experimenter Carl Anderson discovered a particle, apparently knowing nothing about Dirac's prediction. It took another 6 months for physicists to put two and two together and to realise that Dirac's prediction of the anti-electron, the first example of antimatter, was in fact discovered in cosmic rays coming down in California. It was realised what a magnificent thing Dirac had done. He simply used his own imagination with mathematics to conceive antimatter. Now, to really hammer this home, if you look today at what cosmologists think about the early universe, they think of it, the very, very early universe, as consisting of 50% matter mm-hmm. and 50% antimatter. So by that token, Dirac conceived half the universe in his head.
I just want to take you a step back there, because you've mentioned this already, and also the previous book that you edited, which was called It Must Be Beautiful, Great Equations of Modern Science. Einstein himself spoke of his general theory of relativity as being incomparably beautiful.
Mm, yeah.
Why does this matter? Why do you think what's appealing about an equation wanting to be beautiful in that sort of simplistic or beautiful in that sort of way? Do you think?
Well, yeah, it's interesting when you pose that question. For a theoretician looking at an equation like the Dirac equation or Einstein's equations of gravity, the best, most economical way of describing the emotion that that they cause, if you like, is one that you're apprehending genuine beauty. I had this, incidentally, as all theoretical physicists do, when I was looking at Maxwell's equations of electricity and magnetism, which predict, incidentally, that light is an electromagnetic phenomenon. I remember looking at that and thinking, this is such a beautiful theory. Right. Now, what do I mean by that? Mm-hmm. What do theoreticians mean by that? They mean that what they're looking at in their equations is something that isn't just a heap of disconnected stuff. Rather, it's you can't change anything in it. It has a certain inevitability. It has a power and compactness, just like great poetry. Mm-hmm. That's the most compressed and highly charged form of language. The great equations are, if you like, the most compressed, highly charged form of mathematical science, you see? And you can't change anything in it. So you've got the Dirac equation. You see it written down. You can't tinker with it in any way. You can't just say, well, it could be a bit more this or a bit more that. It just is. All the bits fit together like a completed Rubik's Cube, mm-hmm. you know? So that's what they mean by that. And that's what Dirac meant by beauty. And it became a lodestar for him. Unless he could feel that sense of inevitability, of power, of concision, then he believed we were on the wrong track.
So Dirac and any other scientists feel that kind of that moment of revelation almost, which brings us rather neatly on to Dirac's views on religion, in which many other people find that source of revelation. Dirac wasn't too keen.
Well, he was fiercely against it, actually. According to Heisenberg, when they went to the first Solvay conference, I think it was 1926, Dirac was fulminating against religion. In fact, Dirac's colleague, Pauli, said after one of Dirac's homilies against the alleged almighty, there is no God and Dirac is his prophet. Dirac just saw religion as a tool for manipulating the masses. It was a naive, it was a foolish theory and what have you. So he was seen as extremely anti-religious. And in the letters I fortunately came across in my research, he described his own religion to his then girlfriend, later to be his wife, his religion as man can and must improve. You know, it was nothing to do with some entity in the sky or something that was affecting human actions or something like that. So he was very much against religion, but then he did change in his life, and that's what I think is so interesting. Mm-hmm. His wife was brought up I think it was a Lutheran, and she was never, I would think, in a strict sense religious, but she was someone who had great sympathy with religion, particularly Catholicism. And I suspect there was a tension in the marriage between his initial raw atheism and her sceptical Lutheranism, so to speak. They sent their girls to religious schools, which I was amazed to hear that, right? But they mm-hmm. did. And towards the end of his life, there is absolutely no doubt that, the last 10 years or so, he was talking about God a lot, rather like Einstein did, but I believe in the Spinozan sense, yeah. Right? He was thinking about God, in my view, as the manifestation of the ordered harmonies underlying the universe. Right, he certainly, contrary to what his wife was trying to say afterwards, when she gave him a full Protestant funeral, right? With she really made sure, right, that he was depicted as a God fearing, straight down the line Church of England chap, which I'm sure he wasn't, right? But pretty much certain that was not the case. Do you know, even on his gravestone, do you know what she had put there? Because God made it so. And what he was referring to there, right, was it the same spirit as Einstein, mm-hmm. right? That he was thinking of like Dirac, Einstein had this awe of the way you could actually give an order to the universe in these equations.
So, well, Einstein is often co-opted by the religious.
He is,
where they say, look, here's a great physicist who believed in God when plainly he said he didn't.
Yes.
Has the same fate befallen Dirac, do you think?
Yeah, because he's much less famous than Einstein, although, incidentally, a comparable, one of the very few physicists you could put in that same league. But I believe that Dirac's views have been very severely distorted by actually a relatively small number of people. I would say my brief summary would be that Einstein's views were very, very similar to Dirac's views on God. But that's not to say, incidentally, they were deep thinkers about the subject. Right, mm-hmm. They would look beyond the simple notion of God being an old man with grey beard interfering with things and what have you. There's one thing that might interest you here, that Dirac flatly disbelieved in miracles, mm-hmm. right? And his reason for that was, quite unusual. Right? He said he couldn't believe in miracles because if miracles happened, that would imply that the beauty of universal equations would be broken. And he didn't believe that could happen.
Mm. I mean, that's... fantastic point for us to end on. It's quite a profound thing. So we've been talking to Graham Farmelow about his book The Strangest Man, The Hidden Life of Paul Dirac, Quantum Genius, and that's out from Faber and Faber right now. Graham, thanks very much for coming in and talking to us.
My pleasure.
You've been listening to Little Atoms. You can find details of upcoming guests on our website, littleatoms.com. The Little Atoms podcast is available on iTunes. Thanks for listening.